Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. This week's topic is trade. Today's episode is part of the special Transition 2021 series on the President's Inbox. In the weeks running up to Inauguration Day, I'm sitting down with experts to discuss the foreign policy challenges facing the incoming Biden administration. With me to discuss how President-elect Joe Biden will handle U.S. trade policy are Edward Ted Alden and Jennifer Hillman. Ted is the Bernard L. Schwartz Senior Fellow at the Council and the Ross Distinguished Visiting Professor at Western Washington University. He specializes in U.S. economic competitiveness, trade, and immigration policy. His most recent book is Failure to Adjust: How Americans Got Left Behind in the Global Economy. Jennifer is Senior Fellow for Trade and International Political Economy at CFR. She has held numerous trade-related positions in government, including serving as a member of the World Trade Organization's appellate body and general counsel and ambassador and chief textiles negotiator at U.S. Trade Representative. Ted and Jennifer, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Good to be with you, Jim and Jennifer.
I want to discuss how a President Biden will approach trade policy, but before I do that, I want to begin with your assessments of how President Trump handled trade policy and sort of what he is leaving behind for a President Biden. So perhaps I could begin with you first, Ted.
Well, he's leaving behind an extremely full plate. Maybe I'll just mention a few of the biggest items and leave others for Jennifer. But it's not like the Trump administration has gone out quietly. I mean, as listeners will know, there has been a series of ongoing trade conflicts, most notably with China, but also with many U.S. allies. And this is carrying up right up into the final days of the administration. We're about to see new tariffs put in place against France over its new taxes on digital companies, U.S. digital companies like Google and Facebook. We're seeing new tariffs against the European Union in a long-running dispute involving Airbus and Boeing. We may see new tariffs in place against Vietnam, the program to provide trade benefits for developing countries, the so-called GSP, has expired. There is just a whole series of extremely difficult issues that the Biden administration is going to inherit. I mean, I think if you put it in big picture as opposed to the specific disputes, the Trump administration has been a unilateralist administration. It's the place where Trump's philosophy of America first has found its clearest expression. Trump believed long before he became president that the United States was losing in trade, that it was the loser in many of the trade deals it had done, from entering into the WTO arrangements to NAFTA to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which of course President Trump pulled out of on his third day in office. And so as president, he has pursued very much a unilateralist trade policy with little regard for existing international rules and restraints and little regard for traditional U.S. alliances. The incoming Biden administration is promising a much more multilateral approach, promising to work much more closely with allies. So we're going to see what that means. But there is, as I say, just in short, an awful lot of difficult decisions that the Biden administration is going to inherit on day one.
Ted, I want to come back to this question of whether or not President Trump achieved his goals in the trade sphere. But first, I want to get Jennifer to come in and talk a little bit from her perspective, assessing the Trump approach to trade.
Well, first, I would completely agree with Ted. I mean, the hallmark of President Trump's approach has been this idea of putting on tariffs on a unilateral basis on a whole series of goods. So we've seen tariffs go on to steel and aluminum under a theory that imports of steel and aluminum from everywhere in the world threatened the national security of the United States. And then you saw, again, tariffs go on China to the tune of $360 billion worth of tariffs on Chinese imports. And the rest of the world responded to that by putting on their own tariffs on American goods in response. So one of the things that the Biden administration is going to have to decide sort of fairly soon, I think, is what to do about all of those tariffs. Because I think you're starting to see a lot of the analysis come in that would suggest that the tariffs have not been very successful in achieving what their arguably stated goal was. I mean, with respect to China, a lot of the goal was to try to reduce the bilateral deficit, the trade deficit between the United States and China. And what we've seen is that deficit grow ever larger, reaching, you know, again, a very historic high just last month. The tariffs on the steel and the aluminum side were really designed to try to help produce a more competitive steel and aluminum industry and more jobs in that industry. And again, that goal has not been met. So the question is going to come very quickly, kind of what to do about it. And the second part of it is a lot of what Ted spoke about, which is the other thing that the Biden administration is going to have to think about, which is what to do about the multilateral system, meaning most importantly, the World Trade Organization, where the Trump administration has both, in essence, put an end to the WTO's appellate body. It's, if you will, its final appeals court in WTO dispute. So it has refused to let anyone be seated on that appellate body. So the appellate body is now non-functional, and therefore there isn't the same kind of binding dispute settlement mechanism as they have. And secondly, they've come in and blocked a consensus for who should be leading the WTO going forward. There had been a long process that had resulted in basically all of the rest of the world agreeing that one of the candidates that came through the final, Dr. Ngozi from Nigeria, was the best candidate. And at the last minute, the United States, the Trump administration blocked that. And in general, there is a huge concern that the WTO is in a state of crisis, where it has not been able to reach new agreements, where its appellate body is not functioning, where it is leaderless in terms of a new head. So among the other things that's going to have to get addressed right away is what to do about how to reform and get the WTO back on track.
I suspect we're going to come back to the WTO in a minute, but I want to just press a little bit more on the Trump administration agenda. It's quite clear that when it comes to trade policy, Trump's approach was very different from his predecessor's approach. I'm just curious how you assess Trump's ability to achieve his stated goals in trade policy. I take Jennifer's point, Ted, that President Trump talked a lot about driving down the trade deficit. He sort of used it as a scorecard to tell who is winning and who is losing on trade, but the reality is the overall U.S. trade deficit is up. It's not down. But the president would also point out that he got a new version of NAFTA, the USMCA, United States-Mexico-Canada agreement. He negotiated a new trade deal with Korea and negotiated the phase one trade deal with China. So give us a sense, Ted, as to how these all come together. How successful was the Trump policy besides just being different?
Yeah, no, I think that's a great question. And you know, I'll let, you know, Jennifer maybe hammer a few more of the negatives. And she mentioned some of them, certainly in terms of the administration's stated goals regarding trade deficits. If you look at overall manufacturing employment, it was up a bit before the pandemic, but it's down overall. So in terms of sort of, you know, strengthening the manufacturing economy, which was something that was front and center for the Trump administration, hasn't been very successful there. But let me point to two ways in which I think the administration can rightly claim some successes. The first you mentioned has to do with the new NAFTA, USMCA. If you look at where Congress has stood on U.S. trade policy for 25, 30 years now, it's been deeply divided. You know, votes on major trade agreements, you would have most Republicans voting in favor, most Democrats voting against, primarily because of pressure from the labor unions. There has been nothing close to a consensus on the right direction for U.S. trade policy since the original NAFTA vote back in the mid-1990s. If you look at USMCA, it passed with overwhelming support in both the House and the Senate from both Democrats and Republicans. Bob Lighthizer, the trade representative for President Trump, said one of his goals was to try to restore that traditional bipartisanship on trade policy. And I think he can claim to have taken a significant step in that direction. Whether that will hold for other trade negotiations remains to be seen, but he deserves a lot of credit there. The other thing I think is almost more rhetorical. If you listen to what the incoming Biden team is saying about trade, and we're going to talk more about this, it's talking about trade as part of a foreign policy for the middle class, looking very much at the impacts of U.S. international economic policy on ordinary people in the United States. What does this mean in terms of our, you know, the well-being, the pocketbooks of middle class Americans? The trade agenda, I think, for decades was much more focused on liberalization as an end in itself. What did it mean for American companies? What did it mean for overall trade growth? Less about the bottom line for ordinary Americans. And I think Trump really shifted the debate in that direction in some important ways. I think the ways in which he tried to carry out that agenda were often deeply damaging, and we've talked about some of them already. We'll talk about more, but I think you can give him some credit for changing the conversation there.
Jennifer, anything you would point to as a success for the Trump administration?
Well, I would also add that the other thing that where the conversation has really changed is with respect to China. And I think, again, I think the Trump administration has to be given a lot of credit for being much more aggressive in its approach to China. There had been concerns about where China was. China joined the WTO in 2001. And at that time, I think the general perception was China was on a pretty good path. It was opening up its own market. It was becoming a more market-oriented economy. It was allowing more sort of trade and investment in China. And then fairly shortly thereafter, 2005, 2006, China made a complete U-turn and has become much more of a Communist Party-controlled economy and much more closed. And again, previous administrations that had all kinds of discussions with China, but it wasn't until the Trump administration that you saw this very aggressive approach to try to really rein in some of these very negative practices. Now, I will personally say that I don't think they have been very successful in getting at the hard core of what the problems are with China, but I think they deserve credit for changing the conversation around what was going on in China.
So my takeaway there, Jennifer, is that Trump changed the conversation here in the United States. He didn't actually change Chinese behavior, correct?
That is correct.
Let's talk about the approach a Biden administration is going to take to trade policy. And I want to hold off for a sec of diving into the details about specific trade agreements. I want you to describe how Joe Biden thinks about trade policy broadly. You mentioned a moment ago, Ted, that the Biden team has this foreign policy for the middle class slogan. What does it sort of mean in the trade sphere? Because an awful lot of Americans depend on trade for their jobs. I mean, whether you are a farmer or you work for General Motors or you work for Apple, a lot of your company's earnings depend upon the ability to buy and sell with other people.
That's a difficult question to answer because we are still very much with the administration not yet in office at the stage of general conversations about where the team might go. And there are just a lot of differences within the Democratic Party that continue, I think, to be very difficult to paper over. You know, my sense of Joe Biden is he comes out of the more traditional internationalist wing of the party. I mean, he was a supporter of the major trade agreements, including NAFTA and the WTO. And China's admission to the WTO supported the Obama administration's negotiation of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. But I also think he's aware that we're in a very different period here in which a lot of Americans are really hurting economically. The criticisms that President Trump has made about U.S. trade policy, I think, have sunk pretty deeply. And I think he's going to try to find some way to square that circle of being, you know, an Obama-Clinton-type internationalist working closely with allies, but also addressing these deep-seated economic fears and uncertainties here in the United States. The question is how he's going to do that. Now, you know, the one hint we've had so far, and we'll see how this plays out, is that trade is going to go on a bit of a back burner. I mean, he said during the campaign that the priority is making investments here in the United States in infrastructure, in building up our communities, in worker retraining, and that negotiating new trade agreements will only come after those investments are made. But operationalizing that could be pretty difficult. I mean, you could have a Republican-controlled Senate that doesn't want to invest in any of the things that the Biden administration wants to invest in. And what does that mean for trade? And the rest of the world's not just going to sit around waiting for the U.S. to get its own house in order before wanting it to deal with the multiple trade challenges that exist out there in the world right now.
Ted, can I draw you out on that point a bit more? A lot of our conversation rests on an implicit assumption that trade is an important determinant of middle-class economic well-being. A lot of economists I talk to and read tell me that's not true. Trade's impact, other than perhaps the impact in the industrial Midwest because of China's entry into the global economic system, is actually more mixed, that a lot of people benefit from increased trade. And they would point to things like tax policy, education policy, labor rights policy as being far more important than trade in terms of hurting the working class. So from your perspective, how important is trade in these conversations?
You know, we could do a whole separate long discussion on this, but I've been thinking about this question for years, as I know Jennifer has too. I think what we are talking about here is economic disruption. And we know if you look at the economic history of the United States for the last 30 or 40 years, what we see is a picture that looks very different depending on the part of the economy you're connected with. mean, if you're working in the big globally connected cities, if you're in the high technology industries and financial service elsewhere, you've done tremendously well. Globalization has benefited you enormously. Technology has benefited you enormously. In many other parts of the country, it's been very disruptive. I mean, we've had, you know, the emergence of an economy that's bifurcated on all sorts of different dimensions. And so I think trade is only one part of this. And you know, it gets difficult. You know, we have a podcast like this, and we're supposed to talk about trade policy. But as you say, there are all of these other elements that go a long way to determining whether trade liberalization helps most Americans or whether it harms some in rather significant ways. And I really think it's very difficult and probably at the end of the day wrongheaded to try to separate out trade policy and say, okay, here's our trade policy, and we don't care about its impact in all these other areas. You have to get those other pieces right in order to make trade policy work in ways that really benefits Americans. And I think the Biden team clearly gets that, but figuring out how to do that in practice is of course, terribly difficult.
Would you disagree with that assessment, Jennifer?
No, I wouldn't. If anything, I would underscore it, because I do think the change that I think the Biden team is trying to bring to all of this is to say that you have to recognize that trade policy and domestic economic policy are inexorably intertwined, and that you have to make sure that the two work together in tandem, and that we should stop having the conversation about whether trade caused you to lose your job or whether technology caused you to lose your job, and instead start saying, what do we do for that person that has lost their job, because it doesn't really matter to them whether it was trade that was the problem or whether it was technology or something else. And so I think what you are hearing from the Biden team is that we're going to shift the focus to figuring out how do we create a more competitive America. And that's more competitive both domestically and more competitively on the international front, and that we're not going to see them as operating in separate realms. And I think you also see that in what they're saying about the degree to which we're going to need to bring labor and labor rights and labor policy, as well as environment and climate change policy, into trade, and bringing trade and trade agreements into both labor and climate change policy, to understand that these are all at some level integrated and working together. That, I think, is what they are trying to do. I think that's the clear message that you're hearing. And as Ted has said, you know, the difficulty is going to be how do you manage to do all of that?
But I would imagine, Jennifer, that poses a pretty big public policy problem. If people are convinced that trade is overwhelmingly responsible for their problems, that is, they've been done in by unfair competition abroad, but it's actually a range of other issues that are as important or far more important and need to be fixed, that can make it very difficult to have a sensible trade policy, because it puts way too much pressure on trade as an instrument.
Again, you're exactly right in terms of the question. I just am not sure that's really where the American people are. If you look at a lot of the data that you're seeing coming out of public policy polling on this, in many ways, trade is again, the sort of favorability, if you will, of trade, or, you know, do trade agreements or does trade, you know, help or harm Americans? Again, a significant majority of Americans saying that trade helps, that trade is supportive of a positive economic policy. So I don't think everyone accepts this general notion that trade is to be blamed for everything, all of the ills, if you will, in the economy. Again, I do think that to some degree, the Trump administration did try to sort of peddle this message that whatever is ailing you, that your schools are going downhill, your wages haven't kept up with inflation, whatever you see as the economic harm in your neighborhood, blame it on foreign. And that was to some degree both blame it on foreign trade, but also blame it on foreign people. I mean, that's the whole push on stopping immigration. I mean, there was this whole sense of whatever ills, whatever is bothering you, blame it on foreign. I do think that is where you are going to see a change, where I don't think the Biden administration is going to be so inclined to necessarily say whatever is wrong should be blamed on, again, foreign goods, foreign people, foreign investment, foreign services coming into the U.S. economy. And at the same time, like I said, I think you are going to see the Biden administration recognizing that these things are all intertwined with one another, and you do have to have both a domestic policy and a trade policy that support a more competitive America.
I take your point, Jennifer, on what public opinion polls say. I will note that one of the more interesting things is that support for trade has gone up broadly over the last 4 years, and it's gone up particularly significantly among Democrats, though there's been erosion in support for trade among Republicans as well. We'll sort of see where that goes. But you wanted to jump in here, Ted?
I was just going to add one quick point to Jennifer's, I think, very accurate comments on that front. For several decades, the critics of trade kind of had an open field, right? Because the people running the government, Democrats or Republicans, were in favor of trade liberalization. And so the critics said, well, if we weren't going down this road of open trade, we could solve these problems like the disappearance of manufacturing jobs and the very slow growth of wages. We've had a four-year experiment now with an administration that's gone in the opposite direction. And you didn't see this huge surge of manufacturing jobs, as Jennifer pointed, didn't help the steel and aluminum industries appreciably. I think there is an opening now for a more nuanced conversation. That, again, getting back to Jennifer's point, that says that trade is one piece of a much broader set of challenges, rather than, you know, open trade is going to make us all better off or protectionism is the way to go. I think we may be moving finally into a new phase where the conversation becomes a bit more sophisticated. I hope so, anyway.
That may be the case, but I think it's always important we talk about public opinion. There is both the matter of sort of what the broader average person thinks and what the intensely interested think. Because obviously in trade politics, and this goes back to the beginning of the American Republic, it's people who see themselves as having very vested interests at stake in trade policy who are the most politically mobilized trying to shape that conversation, not necessarily the average person who may not think about trade at all. But I'm curious, Jennifer, when you look at the incoming Biden administration, who do you see as the person being the trade guru? We often talk in the Trump administration about Bob Lighthizer, the USTR, as being the point person on trade, though in many respects, it was Donald Trump who was the person who drove trade policy. Who has that role in a Biden administration? Is it Susan Rice in her new role as sort of domestic policy chief? Is it Jake Sullivan, the new national security advisor? Is it Katherine Tai, the new USTR? Who is it that's going to be the person you see driving the conversation?
I think it's too early to tell. And I do think what is important and what has been said pretty clearly is that this is going to be a team effort. In other words, I do think the Biden administration is making clear a number of goals that are going to be, as they call it, whole of government, where they are expecting every agency, including USTR, to be part of the solution. And that includes climate change, where there's going to be an expectation that trade and trade policy is going to contribute to what we're doing on climate change. But it also includes this notion of building back better America, where I do think there is going to be this notion that trade policy is going to have to contribute to that building back better approach. So I think it's too early to know. But what I do think you will see a big change as between the Trump administration and the Biden administration is the degree of interagency cooperation and interagency coordination over where the policy may go. And I think it's too early to know whether it's going to be driven out of the White House, meaning, as you say, Jake Sullivan or Susan Rice, or whether it's going to be driven out of the United States Trade Representative's office, where the new incoming USTR, Katherine Tai, brings a real wealth of experience and strong connections into the Congress and members of Congress and to the various political constituencies that have been weighing in on trade. She is very well steeped and very well positioned to try to be that interagency coordinator. And I think it's just too early to tell where the lead will be.
So, Ted, where do you think Biden will go early in his administration on trade? Do you see him, for example, lifting the tariffs on steel and aluminum, rejoining TPP, taking all of it and just putting under strategic review and coming back in 6 months or 12 months?
I think he'd probably prefer to do that, but I don't think events are going to allow him to do that. The element he has talked about most consistently, he wants to rebuild a level of cooperation, particularly between the United States and the European Union. Whereas under Trump, the U.S. went aggressively after the EU on a whole range of trade issues. So I expect the earliest initiatives to be in that area, trying to do something to negotiate on this digital tax issue with the French, where the Trump administration is saying, look, this just discriminates against American companies. It's a terrible thing. Trying to negotiate a resolution to the long-standing dispute over subsidies for Airbus and Boeing, which is now, after a couple of decades, at the stage of a full-blown tariff war. I think the steel and aluminum tariffs are something he will take a very early look at. So I think the early actions are likely to be in that area. China, I expect, will take longer. He has indicated, again, not clearly, but indicated he's not going to move quickly to lift the tariffs tariffs on China. I think there's some hope of coming up with a common approach with the Europeans, though the Europeans have complicated that with this new investment agreement that they've just announced.
Could you talk about that for a minute, Ted, what the significance of that is, the Europeans negotiating this new investment deal with China just a couple of weeks before Joe Biden is inaugurated as president?
Yeah, I mean, we're going to have to look at the details. And Jennifer, you know, being a lawyer, I think we'll be parsing the text when it finally comes out. But I think at a broad level, what's significant is that the Europeans are making a bet on China living by the rules it negotiates, that there are a series of provisions in this new investment agreement that suggest that the Chinese are going to do various things in terms of increasing foreign access to markets and financial services and telecommunications and services broadly and other areas, that the Chinese may do something on the labor rights front, that the Chinese may do something to restrain state-owned enterprises, which is a longstanding goal of both the U.S. and Europe. That comes at a time, though, when I think here in the United States, and Jennifer mentioned this in terms of the Trump administration's new approach to China, I think there is really a consensus among both Republicans and Democrats that you can't trust the Chinese to make good on the promises that they have made, either in the WTO or in other trade agreements. So I do think it forces the hand of the new administration by saying, we the Europeans believe that the Chinese are going to abide by these commitments they have made. And of course, because there's so many gray areas in this. Alan Beatty made the point recently in the Financial Times that once you do a deal, there is a tendency of governments to want to say that the Chinese are making good on those promises. You've heard that with the Trump administration and the so-called phase one commitments, where China is falling far short, but Bob Lighthizer has been saying, yeah, they're really doing pretty well, and it's because of the pandemic, et cetera. I think the Europeans are going to want to be able to say, yes, China is abiding by these commitments it made to us under the investment agreement, even though I think most of us are skeptical that the Chinese are actually going to do this. So
probably because we've seen the movie
a lot
once
of problems
before
for the new team.
And I would only add, as a political matter, I mean, I do think this is very problematic for the incoming Biden administration. I mean, fairly unusually, Jake Sullivan, you know, the incoming national security advisor, expressly tweeted out that the Biden team would, and I'm going to quote here, welcome early consultations with our European partners on our common concerns about China's economic practices. So he was effectively saying to the Europeans, don't do this. Don't do a unilateral agreement between Europe and China. Wait and let us get together with you and have a common collective approach to China. And the fact that the European Union didn't do that and went ahead with this agreement, I do think is going to make it a little bit harder politically for the Biden administration to join up with the European Union in terms of an approach to China. Substantively, I don't think this agreement moves the needle all that much farther in terms of favoring Europe compared to what the United States got in its phase one deal with China. And I do think it's important to sort of remember that part of the reason why there was so much pressure within Europe to finish this agreement with China is because Europe felt very wronged by the approach that the Trump administration took in its phase one deal. Let's remember that the phase one deal said to China, among other things, buy $200 billion more of American goods, more than what you bought in 2017. But what buying $200 billion more of American goods means is buying $200 billion less of European and Brazilian and Argentine and everybody else's goods. So at some level, those in Europe felt that this was not fair, that the United States was getting this kind of an agreement with China and that it was going to actively harm European producers in terms of their access and their investment provisions with respect to China, and hence this huge pressure building up on the Europeans to go ahead and get this agreement.
Jennifer, that sounds like a major problem for a core driving assumption of the Biden approach to foreign policy, which is, I understand it is, we're going to act more multilaterally. Ted mentioned that at the beginning of our conversation. The idea is to rally around the old gang. We're going to work together. But what you're telling me is we're already seeing signs that the old gang is going to be bringing a lot of irritations and divisions into this conversation, aren't going to clearly sign off to decisions or calls emanating from Washington, D.C. Is this a signal that the Biden foreign policy is going to run aground early on?
I think it's too early to tell. I think there's no question that the Biden administration is clearly indicating that their intention is to work with our trading partners and our allies, and is to try to put more faith in a rules-based trading system, in the World Trade Organization, if we can reform it and restore it, and is going to go down that road. And I think this is a bump in that road, but I don't think it means that it's impossible. And I would say that is, I think, going to be the Biden administration's approach to resolving a lot of these issues. I mean, the steel and the aluminum tariffs, for example. Yes, they were put on unilaterally by the United States, but at the end of the day, the solution to the problem that was driving those tariffs in the first place was overproduction and overcapacity in China, flooding the world with too much steel and too much aluminum, pushing down prices for everybody. And so at some level, the solution is for everybody to get together and figure out how do you cut back on those levels of overproduction and oversupply. So the solution to a lot of the trade problems that the Biden administration is going to inherit, what to do about steel and aluminum tariffs, what to do about the China problems, what to do about fixing the WTO, all of those are going to require a coalition, and it is going to require getting together with all of our trading partners. So I think that is going to be sort of the number one message that I think the Biden team is going to want to send, is that we intend to and want to work with our allies and our partners on our approaches to these problematic trade issues.
Ted, I want to go back to a point you made, which is, as I understand it, the Biden team is going to come in and it's going to take its time before it really embraces trade issues. It wants to make this down payment on improving things for the middle class, a down payment that could be very hard to make, given, as you pointed out, Republicans may be opposed to a lot of what it is that Joe Biden talked about doing on the campaign trail. But while Americans are sort of putting trade on hold, my sense is that America's trading partners, as testified by the European-China investment agreement, aren't sitting around waiting for the Americans to decide they want to play. They've moved ahead on a variety of fronts. And this isn't a trivial issue. It's a very significant issue because as more deals get made, it actually puts American exporters at a disadvantage. So are events going to force a Biden administration to take on trade issues sooner rather than later?
Yes, I think there are events. You know, we talked about some of them in Europe. I think clearly there are going to be some with China. We've got Vietnam. We've got issues with Canada. There are going to be events that are going to force the Biden administration to deal with trade. But your question is more, is the Biden administration going to want to get back on the path of trade liberalizing deals? For instance, looking maybe to rejoin the Trans-Pacific Partnership, doing a new trade deal with the UK. I think that's just a much harder ask. These things remain very contentious here in the United States. And I think, you know, if you're actually looking over the last couple of decades, the story you laid out there of the U.S. largely standing aside while other countries are continuing to do these trade liberalizing agreements, that's the way it's been for a while. I mean, we're not part of the TPP that exists now in Asia. You have the new Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership led by China with many of those same Asian countries. The Europeans have been negotiating a broad range of new trade deals with Canada and Japan and others. And the U.S. has not been moving forward much on any of these fronts, largely because we've been so gridlocked domestically. I don't see that picture changing quickly. I think there's going to be real challenges for the Biden administration to move forward with any kind of trade liberalization agenda. And I think there are likely to be growing disadvantages for companies exporting from the United States because other countries are doing trade deals and we're not doing them.
Jennifer, can I draw you out on that issue of sort of the domestic impediments? Because one of the things that stands out to me is that doing trade deals in the United States really requires having something known as trade promotion authority. That's an agreement under which Congress says, okay, President, you can negotiate the agreement. We'll vote on it up or down. We won't try to amend it after it's negotiated. But the current version of TPA is set to expire, I think, in July of this year. And effectively, if you want to take advantage of it, you have to get a deal done maybe mid-March or late March. After that, you're back to any bill that comes over is going to be one that Congress can amend, renegotiate, which means it won't happen. Is there a chance that the Biden administration can put together a coalition to extend TPA, to create a new TPA? Or are we going to go into this world in which the president really is not going to be able to negotiate deals?
I think the decision on whether or not to seek the extension of the Trade Promotion Authority or the renewal of it is going to be a decision that the administration is going to have to make fairly early in its term. Because if it wants to get Trade Promotion Authority, it's going to have to be putting together all of the legislative work that it's going to take to do that right away. And my own view is I think it's probably not going to happen because it will take a significant amount of political capital by the Biden administration to push on Congress to come up with a new Trade Promotion Authority package. And typically that package includes a lot of details about what should be the trade negotiating agenda of the United States. How much should labor? How much should environment? How much should a whole series of issues come into play? How far are we going to go in pressing for intellectual property rights? Are we or are we not going to have investor-state dispute settlement? I mean, there's a whole series of matters that you have to decide. Are you going to include them in this kind of an agreement or not? Who are our trading partners going to be? I mean, who are we seeking trade agreements with? I mean, we've already opened, the Trump administration has opened negotiations with the United Kingdom and with Kenya. So the question is, you know, are we going to try to even seek agreement to conclude those agreements? And if not, are we seeking something else? Like I said, this is a very heavy political lift, a very heavy lift where there's not a big consensus and there's nothing driving the Congress to say, okay, now we have to do this. And yet, again, it's to some degree a knock, if you will, for any president to be without trade promotion authority. I mean, to lack that authority, even for a limited period of time, is seen as, you know, the Biden administration starting off with less authority and less ability and less maneuvering room than the Trump administration had or the Obama administration had or other administrations have had.
Okay, I'm going to ask both of you to put your prediction caps on and tell me where you think we're going to be in the trade conversation here in the United States a year from now. Will things be pretty much where they are as the Biden presidency starts? Are there a couple of critical issues where you anticipate the Biden administration making some breakthroughs? Is it possible we could have major reversals? Ted, what future do you see?
I mean, I think by far the biggest issue is the one we've actually maybe talked about the least, and that's what to do with respect to China. Because there really are, you know, to oversimplify, kind of two paths. One is to try to find a new way to re-engage with China and imagine that it's possible to mostly have a cooperative trading relationship with China. That's kind of the bet the EU is making by doing this investment deal. The other path, which I actually think is more likely, is that we're going to see growing decoupling, that we see China as a major threat to the United States, that China's drive for technological leadership in a series of sectors which matter deeply for national security means that the United States should be trying to thwart China's technological progress, should be continuing to extend sanctions on critical products, which has been done under the Trump administration. My prediction would be that a year from now, we are farther down that road to decoupling, that having a Biden administration does not change that essential dynamic, which is the United States now sees, in a way it didn't when China was admitted to the WTO in 2001, now sees China's economic rise as a strategic and security threat. And therefore, economic policy is going to become one of a variety of tools used to try to constrain China's progress. So my prediction is we're going to see a lot less change on China than might be imagined by having a new administration which is more open to multilateralism and cooperation.
Well, I have to ask you, Ted, how far do you think the United States can go down the decoupling road before it hurts its own economy?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, it is hurting its own economy already. I mean, I think there are real costs to technology companies that are already being paid. I think loss of access to the Chinese market has a real cost. But, you know, I mean, you're a security guy, you know these things, right? At the end of the day, I think the questions of what is threatening to U.S. national security are going to take precedence over economic gain. And it'll be played out issue by issue and sector by sector. I mean, you know, trade in toys isn't a problem. I think trade in most farm products isn't a problem. There'll be a lot of areas that are not terribly controversial. But I think in all of the areas on which future economic prosperity depends, all of those high technology areas, artificial intelligence, and biotechnology, and advanced aviation, and we could go down the list, I think that the United States is is going to move more and more in the direction of decoupling, whatever the economic price might be. And that's why, you know, we'll get back much more, and you can see this already, into discussions of domestic industrial policy, right? I mean, if we're not going to be relying on China for medical equipment and pharmaceuticals so much, what are we going to do here domestically to make sure that we've got the capacity we need? How are we going to work with allies in those areas? I think that's a conversation that has really accelerated over the last year, that is going to accelerate even further, I think, over the next year.
So Jennifer, where do you see us a year from now?
So I wouldn't disagree with Ted's view that I think China is going to be this front and center issue, but I'll say that I do think two issues where I think you will see something different from where we are right now. And one is, I think you're going to see a much even further deepening of our regional relationships with Canada and Mexico, brought about both by the USMCA and by, in general, I think as we, if you will, decouple from China, where is that production going to go? I think it's going to come back to North America. So I think you are going to see, if you will, a rise in regionalism or a greater coordination of regionalism. And it will become clear that as we go more regional, that actually has more benefits for American jobs. I mean, in the sense that the imports that are coming in from Mexico or Canada have a much higher amount of U.S. content, U.S. labor embedded in them than do straight up imports from China. The second one is the area that we haven't talked about, but where I do think, or at least maybe I'm more in the, I hope that we will see progress, is in whether we can reform the World Trade Organization, which, like I said, is in a state of crisis right now. And I do believe that the Biden administration will at least make an effort to try to bring about a reformed, revitalized, reinvigorated World Trade Organization. Maybe it won't be able to take on the problems of China. So again, it may be that we've got to think about a different relationship in terms of the WTO and China, but in terms of the WTO as a base, hard core of rules that are predictable and stable and that govern the keeping open of supply chains and a lot of other things, I do think there will be an emphasis on trying to do what can be done to try to reform the WTO so that it works better for American interests and for those around the world.
Just quickly, Jennifer, why is reforming or fixing the WTO important for Americans and American workers? How would you tie it to the Biden pledge to make foreign policy work for the middle class?
So at its core, to me, what the WTO does is protect Americans, American goods, American services, American products from discrimination. I mean, because what the WTO says is you cannot discriminate against us just because we're American or just because we're foreign in your market. You cannot discriminate on those terms. And that discipline against discrimination, I think, becomes very, very important for many, many American products, where American companies and American workers need to know that their products can continue to be traded under rules that are known, stable, predictable, transparent. And that's really what the WTO does, is make sure that we're not discriminated against in a way that is very unfair and is unpredictable. And that is an important discipline. And the question then is, how do you get back to that? And at the same time, I think, how do you restore the ability of the WTO to reach agreements in new areas? And the one that's really important for the United States is in digital trade, in digital services and digital goods, where everybody needs some real rules of the road, so that we're not having every country set up their own rules on everything from data privacy to where do you have to store your data, to can you require that data be held locally, can you put a tax on digitally traded goods or services. It feeds in a little bit to this French tax on digital services. So that whole area of what are we going to do about digital trade, the United States, just as much as a lot of the rest of the world, needs to have global rules that set the basic rules of the road. So I think in that sense, it's not going to be enough to have bilateral or regional agreements that cover those kind of really core disciplines. So I think there will be a need to restore, reform, revitalize the World Trade Organization to work for American interests.
On that note, I'll close up the President's Inbox for this week. My guests have been Ted Alton, Bernard L. Schwartz Senior Fellow here at the Council, and Jennifer Hillman, who's a Senior Fellow for Trade and International Political Economy here at CFR. Ted and Jennifer, thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Jim.
Great to be here. Thank you, Jim.
Please subscribe to the President's Inbox on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and leave us a review. They help us get noticed and improve the show. As always, opinions expressed in the President's Inbox are solely those of the host or our guests, not a CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's episode was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlick. Zoe did double duty as a recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe. Special thanks to Margaret Gatch for her assistance. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.